The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the 12th reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. The French police come for Rachel and Ari, and before she's shoved onto the cattle car, she hands her son Ari to Vian. Take him. Save him. Later, when Vian hears that Ari will be taken as well, she decides to tell them he's an adopted family member. Meanwhile, Isabel is out in the fields when an American plane crashes. The pilot is wounded and is taken to Vian's hiding place in the barn. The next day, Beck comes searching for him, and as he finds the hiding place, Vian hits him in the head with a shovel, and Isabel shoots him in the chest. Isabel is wounded, but Vian is able to stitch the wound. Now we continue with The Nightingale. At last she sat back, staring down at her bloody hands and bloodied skirt. Isabel looked so pale and frail, not herself at all. Her hair was filthy and matted, her clothes were wet with her own blood and the airman's, and she looked young, so young. Vian felt shame so deep it made her sick to her stomach. Had she really told her sister, to go away and not come back? How often had Isabel heard that in her life, and from her own family, from people who were supposed to love her? "I'll take her to the safe house in Brantôme," the black-haired one said. "Oh, no, you won't," Vian said. She looked up from her sister, saw that the three men were standing together by the wagon, conspiring. She got to her feet. "She's not going anywhere with you. You're the reason she's here." "She's the reason we're here," the dark-haired man said. "I'm taking her. Now." Vian approached the young man. There was a look in his eyes, an intensity that ordinarily would have frightened her. But she was beyond fear now, beyond caution. "I know who you are," Vian said. "She described you to me. You're the one from Tours who left her with a note pinned to her chest as if she were a stray dog. Gaston, right?" "Gaetan," he said in a voice that was so soft she had to lean toward him to hear. "And you should know about that. Aren't you the one who couldn't bother to be her sister when she needed one? If you try to take her away from me, I'll kill you." "You'll kill me," he said, smiling. She cocked her head toward Beck. "I killed him with a shovel, and I liked him." "Enough," Henri said, stepping between them. "She can't stay here, Vian. Think about it. The Germans are going to come looking for their dead captain. They don't need to find a woman with a gunshot wound and false papers. You understand?" The big man stepped forward. "We'll bury the captain and the airman, and we'll make sure the motorcycle disappears. Gaetan, you get her to a safe house in the free zone." Vian looked from man to man. "But it's after curfew, and the border is 4 miles away, and she's wounded. How will..." Halfway through the question, she figured out the answer. The coffin. Vian took a step back. The idea of it was so terrible, she shook her head. "I'll take care of her," Gaetan said. Vian didn't believe him, not for a second. "I'm going with you, as far as the border. Then I'll walk back when I see that you've gotten her to the free zone." "You can't do that," Gaetan said. She looked up at him. "You'd be surprised what I can do. Now, let's get her out of here." Chapter 26, May 6, 1995, The Oregon Coast. "That damned invitation is haunting me. I'd swear it has a heartbeat. For days I have ignored it, but on this bright spring morning, I find myself at the counter, staring down at it. Funny, I don't remember walking over here, and yet, here I am." Another woman's hand reaches out. It can't be my hand, not that veiny, big-knuckled monstrosity that trembles. She picks up the envelope. This other woman. Her hands are shaking, even more than usual. "Please join us at the AFI's reunion in Paris on May 7th, 1995, the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. For the first time, families and friends of Passeurs will come together in gratitude to honor the extraordinary Nightingale, also known as Juliette Gervais, in the Grand Ballroom of the Ile-de-France Hotel in Paris, 7 p.m. Beside me, the phone rings. As I reach for it, the invitation slips from my grasp, falls to the counter. Hello? Someone is talking to me in French. Or am I imagining that? Is this a sales call? I ask, confused. No, it is about our invitation. I almost dropped the phone in surprise. It has been most difficult to track you down, madame. I am calling about the Passeurs reunion tomorrow night. We are gathering to celebrate the people who made the Nightingale escape route so successful. Did you receive the invitation? Oui, I say, clutching the receiver. The first one we sent you was returned, I am sorry to say. Please forgive the tardiness of the invitation, but will you be coming? It is not me people want to see. It's Juliet, and she hasn't existed for a long time. You couldn't be more wrong, madame. Seeing you would be meaningful to many people. I hang up the phone so hard it's like smashing a bug. But suddenly, the idea of going back, going home, is in my mind. It's all I can think about. For years, I kept the memories at bay. I hid them in a dusty attic, far from prying eyes. I told my husband, my children, myself, that there was nothing for me in France. I thought I could come to America and make this new life for myself and forget what I had done to survive. Now I can't forget. Do I make a decision, a conscious, let's think it out and decide what's best kind of decision? No. I make a phone call to my travel agent and book a flight to Paris, through New York. Then I pack a bag. It's small, just a rolling carry-on, the sort of suitcase that a businesswoman would take on a 2-day trip. In it, I pack some nylons, a few pairs of slacks, and some sweaters, the pearl earrings that my husband bought me on our 40th anniversary, and some other essentials. I have no idea what I will need, and I'm not really thinking straight anyway. Then I wait. Impatiently. At the last minute, after I have called a taxi, I call my son and get his message machine. A bit of luck, that. I don't know if I would have the courage to tell him the truth straight up. Hello, Julien, I say as brightly as I can. I am going to Paris for the weekend. My flight leaves at 1:10, and I'll call you when I arrive to let you know I'm all right. Give my love to the girls. I pause, knowing how he will feel when he gets this message, how it will upset him. That's because I have let him think I am weak all these years. He watched me lean on his father and defer to his decision-making. He heard me say, if that's what you think, dear, a million times. He watched me stand on the sidelines of his life instead of showing him the field of my own. This is my fault. It's no wonder he loves a version of me that is incomplete. I should have told you the truth. When I hang up, I see the taxi pull up out front, and I go. Chapter 27, October 1942, France. Vianne sat with Gaetan in the front of the wagon, with the coffin thumping in the wooden bed behind them. The trail through the woods was hard to find in the dark. They were constantly starting and stopping and turning. At some point, it started to rain. The only words they'd exchanged in the last hour and a half were directions. There, Vianne said later as they reached the end of the woods, a light shone up ahead, straining through the trees, turning them into black slashes against a blinding white. The border. Oh, Gaetan said, pulling back on the reins. Vianne couldn't help thinking about the last time she'd been here. How will you cross? It's after curfew, she said, clasping her hands together to still their trembling. I will be Laurence Olivier, a man overcome by grief, taking his beloved sister home to be buried. What if they check her breathing? Then someone at the border will die, he said quietly. Vianne heard what he didn't say as clearly as the words he chose. She was so surprised that she couldn't think how to respond. He was saying he would die to protect Isabel. He turned to her, gazed at her, gazed, not looked. Again she saw the predator intensity in those gray eyes, but there was more there, too. He was waiting, patiently, for what she would say. It mattered to him somehow. My father came home chained from the Great War, she said quietly, surprising herself with the admission. This was not something she talked about. Angry, mean, he started drinking too much. While Maman was alive, he was different. She shrugged. After her death, there was no pretense anymore. He sent Isabel and me away to live with a stranger. We were both just girls and heartbroken. The difference between us was that I accepted the rejection. I closed him out of my life and found someone else to love me. But Isabel, she doesn't know how to concede defeat. She hurled herself at the cold wall of our father's disinterest for years, trying desperately to gain his love. Why are you telling me this? Isabel seems unbreakable. She has a steel exterior, but it protects a candy floss heart. Don't hurt her. That's what I'm saying. If you don't love her, I do. Vianne studied him. Does she know? I hope not. Vianne would not have understood that answer a year ago. She wouldn't have understood how dark a side love could have, how hiding it was the kindest thing you could do sometimes. I don't know why it's so easy for me to forget how much I love her. We start fighting and... Sisters. Vianne sighed. I suppose, although I haven't been much of one to her. You'll get another chance. Do you believe that? His silence was answer enough. At last he said, Take care of yourself, Vianne. She'll need a place to come home to when all of this is over. If it's ever over. Oui. Vianne got down from the wagon. Her boots sunk deep into the wet, muddy grass. I'm not sure she thinks of me as a safe place to come home to, she said. You'll need to be brave, Gaetan said. When the Nazis come looking for their man, you know our real names. That's dangerous for all of us, you included. I'll be brave, she said. You just tell my sister that she needs to start being afraid. For the first time, Gaetan smiled, and Vianne understood how the scrawny, sharp-featured man in his beggar's clothes had swept Isabel off her feet. He had the kind of smile that inhabited every part of his face, his eyes, his cheeks. There was even a dimple. I wear my heart on my sleeve, that smile said, and no woman could be unmoved by such transparency. Oui, he said, because it is so easy to tell your sister anything. Fire. It's all around her, leaping, dancing, a bonfire. She can see it in quivering strands of red that come and go. A flame licks her face, burns deep. It's everywhere, and then it's gone. The world is icy, white, sheer and cracked. She shivers with the cold, watches her fingers turn blue and crackle and break apart. They fall away like chalk, dusting her frozen feet. Isabel, bird song, a nightingale. She hears it singing a sad song. Nightingales mean loss, don't they? Love that leaves or doesn't last or never existed in the first place. There's a poem about that, she thinks. An ode. No, not a bird. A man. The king of the fire, maybe. A prince in hiding in the frozen woods. A wolf. She looks for footprints in the snow. Isabel, wake up. She heard his voice in her imagination. Gaetan. He wasn't really here. She was alone. She was always alone. And this was too strange to be anything but a dream. She was hot and cold and achy and worn out. She remembered something, a loud noise. Vianne's voice. Don't come back. I'm here. She felt him sit beside her. The mattress shifted to accommodate his imaginary weight. Something cool and damp pressed to her forehead, and it felt so good that she was momentarily distracted. And then she felt his lips graze hers and linger there. He said something she couldn't quite hear, and then he drew back. She felt the end of the kiss as deeply as she'd felt the start of it. It felt so real. She wanted to say, "Don't leave me," but she couldn't do it. Not again. She was so tired of begging people to love her. Besides, he wasn't really here, so what would be the point of saying anything? She closed her eyes and rolled away from the man who wasn't there. Vianne sat on Beck's bed. Ridiculous that she thought of it that way, but there it was. She sat in this room that had become his, hoping that it wouldn't always be his in her mind. In her mind was the small portrait of his family. You would love Hilda, here, she sent you this strudel, madame, for putting up with a lout such as myself. Vianne swallowed hard. She didn't cry for him again. She refused to, but God, she wanted to cry for herself. for what she had done, for who she had become. She wanted to cry for the man she'd killed and the sister who might not live. It had been an easy choice, killing Beck to save Isabel. So why had Vianne been so quick to turn on Isabel before? You are not welcome here. How could she have said that to her own sister? What if those were among the last words ever spoken between them? As she sat, staring at the portrait, "Tell my family." She waited for a knock at the door. It had been 48 hours since Beck's murder. The Nazis should be here any minute. It wasn't a question of if, but when. They would bang on her door and push their way inside. She had spent hours trying to figure out what to do. Should she go to the commandant's office and report Beck missing? No, foolish. What French person would report such a thing? Or should she wait until they came to her? Never a good thing. Or should she try to run? That only made her remember Sarah and the moonlit night that would forever make her think of bloody streaks on a child's face and brought her right back to the beginning again. "Maman," Sophie said, standing in the open doorway, the toddler on her hip. "You need to eat something," Sophie said. She was taller, almost Vianne's height. When had that happened? And she was thin. Vianne remembered when her daughter had had apple-like cheeks and eyes that sparkled with mischief. Now she was like all of them, stretched as thin as jerky and aged beyond her years. "They're going to come to the door soon," Vianne said. She'd said it so often in the past 2 days that her words surprised no one. "You'll remember what to do." Sophie nodded solemnly. She knew how important this was, even if she didn't know what had become of the captain. Interestingly, she hadn't asked. Vianne said, "If they take me away..." "They won't," Sophie said. "And if they do," Vianne said, "we wait for you to return for 3 days, and then we go to Mother Maria Therese at the convent." Someone pounded on the door. Vianne lurched to her feet so fast she stumbled sideways and hit her hip into the corner of the table, dropping the portrait. The glass on it cracked. "Upstairs, Sophie, now." Sophie's eyes bulged, but she knew better than to speak. She tightened her hold on the toddler and ran upstairs. When Vianne heard the bedroom door slam shut, she smoothed her worn skirt. She had dressed carefully in a gray wool cardigan and an often mended black skirt. A respectable look. Her hair had been curled and carefully styled into waves that softened her thin face. The pounding returned. She allowed herself one indrawn, calming breath as she crossed the room. Her breathing was almost steady as she opened the door. Two German Schutzstaffel SS soldiers stood there, wearing sidearms. The shorter of the two pushed past Vianne, shoving her out of his way as he entered the house. He strode from room to room, pushing things aside, sending what few knick-knacks remained crashing to the floor. At Beck's room, he stopped and turned back. "This is Hauptmann's Beck's room?" Vianne nodded. The taller soldier came at Vianne fast, leaning forward as if there were a harsh wind at his back. He looked down at her from on high, his forehead obscured by a shiny military cap. "Where is he?" How would I know?" "Who is upstairs?" the soldier demanded. "I hear something." It was the first time she'd ever been asked about Ari. "My children..." The lie caught in her voice, came out too soft. She cleared her throat and tried again. "You may go up there, of course, but please don't waken the baby. He's sick with the flu, or perhaps tuberculosis." This last she added because she knew how frightened the Nazis were of getting sick. She reached down for her handbag, clamped it to her chest as if it offered some protection. He nodded at the other German, who strode confidently up the stairs. She heard him moving around overhead. The ceiling creaked. Moments later, he came back downstairs and said something in German. "Come with us," the taller one said. "I'm sure you have nothing to hide." He grabbed Vianne's arm and dragged her out to the black Citroen parked by the gate. He shoved her into the back seat and slammed the door shut. Vianne had about 5 minutes to consider her situation before they stopped again and she was being yanked up the stone steps of the town hall. There were people all around the square, soldiers and locals. The villagers dispersed quickly when the Citroën pulled up. "It's Vianne Mauriac," she heard someone say, a woman. The Nazi's hold on her upper arm was bruising, but she made no sound as he pulled her into the town hall and down a set of narrow steps. There, he shoved her through an open door and slammed it shut. It took her eyes a moment to adjust to the gloom. She was in a small, windowless room with stone walls and a wood floor. A desk sat in the middle of the room, decorated with a plain black lamp that delivered a cone of light onto the scratch wood. Behind the desk and in front of it were straight-backed wooden chairs. She heard the door open behind her and then close. Footsteps followed. She knew someone had come up behind her. She could smell his breath, sausage and cigarettes, and the musky scent of his sweat. "Madame," he said, so close to her ear that she flinched. Hands clamped around her waist, squeezing tightly. "Do you have any weapons?" he said, his terrible French drawing sibilance from the words. He felt up her side, slid his spidery fingers across her breast, giving the smallest of squeezes, and then felt down her legs. "No weapons. Good." He walked past her and took his seat at the desk. Blue eyes peered out from beneath his shiny black military hat. "Sit." She did as she was told, folding her hands into her lap. "I am Sturmbannführer von Richter. You are Madame Vianne Mauriac?" She nodded. "You know why you are here," he said, taking a cigarette from his pocket, lighting it with a match that glowed in the shadows. "No," she said, her voice unsteady, her hands shaking just a little. "Hauptmann Beck is missing." "Missing? Are you certain?" "When is the last time you saw him, Madame?" She frowned. "I hardly keep track of his movements, but if pressed, I would say 2 nights ago. He was quite agitated." "Agitated?" "It was the downed airman. He was most unhappy that he had not been found. Herr Captain believed someone was hiding him." "Someone?" Vianne forced herself not to look away, nor did she tap her foot nervously on the floor or scratch the itch that was making its uncomfortable way across her neck. "He searched all day for the airman. When he came home, he was... agitated is the only word I know how to use. He drank an entire bottle of brandy and broke a few things in my house in his rage. And then..." She paused, letting her frown deepen. "And then?" "I'm sure it means nothing at all." He slammed his palm down on the table so hard the light shuddered. "What?" Herr Captain suddenly said, "I know where he's hiding," and grabbed his sidearm and left my home, slamming the door shut behind him. I saw him jump on his motorcycle and take off down the road at an unsafe speed, and then nothing. He never returned. I assumed he was busy at the Kommandantur. As I said, his comings and goings are not my concern. The man drew a long drag on his cigarette. The tip glowed red and then slowly faded to black. Ash rained down on the desk. He studied her from behind a veil of smoke. "A man would not want to leave a woman as beautiful as yourself." Vianne didn't move. "Well," he said at last, dropping his cigarette butt to the floor. He stood abruptly and stomped on the still-lit cigarette, grinding on it with his boot heel. "I suspect the young Hauptmann is not as skilled with a gun as he should have been. The Wehrmacht," he said, shaking his head, "often they are a disappointment. Disciplined, but not eager." He came out from behind the desk and walked toward Vianne. As he neared, she stood. "Politeness demanded it. The Hauptmann's misfortune is my fortune." "Oh?" His gaze moved down her throat to the pale skin above her breasts. "I need a new place to billet. The Hotel Bellevue is unsatisfactory. I believe your house will do nicely." When Vianne stepped out of the town hall, she felt like a woman who'd just washed ashore. She was unsteady on her feet and trembling slightly. Her palms were damp, her forehead itchy. Everywhere she looked in the square was soldiers. These days the black SS uniforms were predominant. She heard someone yell, "Halt!" And she turned, saw a pair of women in ratty coats with yellow stars on their chests being shoved to their knees by a soldier with a gun. The soldier grabbed one of the two and dragged her to her feet while the older one screamed. It was Madame Fournier, the butcher's wife. Her son Giles yelled, "You can't take my maman," and started to surge at two French policemen who were nearby. A gendarme grabbed the boy, yanked hard enough to make him stop. "Don't be a fool." Vianne didn't think. She saw her former student in trouble, and she went to him. He was just a boy, for God's sake, Sophie's age. Vianne had been his teacher since before he could read. "What are you doing?" she demanded to know, realizing a second too late that she should have tempered her voice. The policeman turned to look at her. Paul. He was even fatter than the last time she'd seen him. His face had puffed out enough to make his eyes as small and slitted as sewing needles. "Stay out of this, madame," Paul said. "Madame Mauriac," Giles cried. "They're taking my maman to the train. I want to go with her." Vianne looked at Giles' mother, Madame Fournier, the butcher's wife, and saw defeat in her eyes. "Come with me, Giles," Vianne said without really thinking. "Merci," Madame Fournier whispered. Paul yanked Giles close again. "Enough. The boy is making a scene. He is coming with us." "No," Vianne said. "Paul, please. We are all French." She hoped the use of his name would remind him that before all of this, they'd been a community. She'd taught his daughters. "The boy is a French citizen. He was born here." "We don't care where he was born, madame. He's on my list. He goes." His eyes narrowed. "Do you want to lodge a complaint?" Madame Fournier was crying now, clutching her son's hand. The other policeman blew his whistle and prodded Giles forward with the barrel of his gun. Giles and his mother stumbled into the crowd of others being herded toward the train station. "We don't care where he was born, madame." Beck had been right. Being French would no longer protect Ari. She clamped her handbag tightly beneath her armpit and headed for home. As usual, the road had turned to mud and ruined her shoes by the time she reached the gate at Le Jardin. Both of the children were waiting in the living room. Relief loosened her shoulders. She smiled tiredly as she set down her handbag. "You're all right," Sophie said. Ari immediately moved toward her, grinning, opening his arms for a hug. "Say, maman," with a grin to prove that he understood the rules of their new game. She pulled the three-year-old into her arms and held him tightly. To Sophie, she said, "I was questioned and released. That is the good news." "And the bad news?" Vianne looked at her daughter, defeated. Sophie was growing up in a world where boys in her class were put in train carriages like cattle at the point of a gun and perhaps never seen again. "Another German is going to billet here. Will he be like Herr Captain Beck?" Vianne thought of the feral gleam in von Richter's ice-blue eyes and the way he had searched her. "No," she said softly, "I don't expect he will be. You are not to speak to him unless you must. Don't look at him. Just stay as invisible as you can. And Sophie, they're deporting French-born Jews now, children too, putting them on trains and sending them away to work camps." Vianne tightened her hold on Rachel's son. "He is Daniel now, your brother, always, even when we are alone. The story is that we adopted him from a relative in Nice. We can never make a mistake or they'll take him, and us, away. You understand? I don't want anyone to ever even look at his papers." "I'm scared, maman," she said quietly. "As am I, Sophie," was all Vianne can say. They were in this together now, taking this terrible risk. Before she could say more, there was a knock on the door. Sturmbannführer von Richter walked into her home, standing as straight as a bayonet blade, his face impassive beneath the glossy black military hat. Silver iron crosses hung from various places on his black uniform, his stand-up collar, his chest. A swastika pin decorated his left breast pocket. "Madame Mauriac," he said, "I see you walked home in the rain." "Mais oui," she answered, smoothing the damp, frizzy hair from her face. "You should have asked my men for a ride. A beautiful woman such as yourself should not slog through the mud like a heifer to the trough." "Oui, merci. I will be so bold as to ask them next time." He strode forward without removing his hat. He looked around, studying everything. She was sure that he noticed the marks on the wall where paintings had once hung, and the empty mantle and the discoloration in the floor where rugs had lain for decades, all gone now. "Yes, this will do," he looked at the children. "And who have we here?" he asked in terrible French. "My son," Vianne said, standing beside him, moving in close enough to touch them both. She didn't say Daniel, in case Ari corrected her. "And my daughter, Sophie." "I do not remember Hauptmann Beck mentioning two children." "And why would he, Herr Sturmbannführer? It is hardly noteworthy." "Well," he said, nodding crisply to Sophie, "you, girl, go get my bags." To Vianne he said, Show me the rooms. I will choose the one I want. Chapter 28. Isabel woke in a pitch-black room, in pain. You're awake, aren't you? Said a voice beside her. She recognized Gaetan's voice. How often in the past 2 years had she imagined lying in bed with him? Gaetan, she said, and with his name came the memories. The barn. Beck. She sat up so fast her head spun and dizziness hit her hard. Vianne, she said, your sister is fine. He lit the oil lamp and left it on the overturned apple crate by the bed. The butterscotch glow embraced them, created a small oval world in the blackness. She touched the spot of pain in her shoulder, wincing. The bastard shot me, she said, surprised to realize that such a thing could be forgotten. She remembered Harding the airman and getting caught by Vianne. She remembered being in the cellar with the dead flyer. And you shot him. She remembered Beck flinging the hatch door open and pointing his pistol at her. She remembered 2 gunshots and climbing out of the cellar, staggering, feeling dizzy. Had she known she'd been shot? Vianne, holding a shovel, covered in gore. Beside her, Beck, in a pool of blood. Vianne, pale as chalk, trembling. I killed him. After that, her memories were jumbled, except for Vianne's anger. You are not welcome here. If you return, I'll turn you in myself. Isabel lay back down slowly. The pain of that memory was worse than her injury. For once, Vianne had been right to cast Isabel out. What had she been thinking to hide the airmen on her sister's property, with the German Wehrmacht captain billeted there? No wonder people didn't trust her. How long have I been here? 4 days. Your wound is much improved. Your sister stitched it up nicely. Your fever broke yesterday. And Vianne? She is not fine, of course. So how is she? We protected her as best we could. She refused to go into hiding. So Henri and Didier buried both bodies and cleaned the barn and tore the motorcycle down to parts. She'll be questioned, Isabel said. And killing that man will haunt her. Hating doesn't come easy for her. It will before this war is over. Isabel felt her stomach tighten in shame and regret. I love her, you know, or I want to. How come I forget that the minute we disagree about something? She said something very similar at the frontier. Isabel started to roll over and gasped at the pain in her shoulder. Taking a deep breath, she steeled herself and eased slowly onto her side. She'd misjudged how close he was to her, how small the bed. They were lying like lovers, she on her side looking up at him, he on his back staring at the ceiling. Vianne went to the border. You were in a coffin in the back of the wagon. She wanted to make sure we crossed safely. She heard a smile in his voice, or imagined she did. She threatened to kill me if I didn't take good care of you. My sister said that? She said, not quite believing it. But she hardly believed that Gaetan was the kind of man who would lie to reunite sisters. In profile, his features were razor sharp, even by lamplight. He refused to look at her, and he was as close to the edge of the bed as he could be. She was afraid you'd die. We both were. He said it so softly she barely could hear. It feels like old times, she said cautiously, afraid to say the wrong thing. More afraid to say nothing at all. Who knew how many chances there would be in such uncertain times? You and me alone in the dark, remember? I remember. Tours already feels like a lifetime ago, she went on. I was just a girl. He said nothing. Look at me, Gaetan. Go to sleep, Isabel. You know I will keep asking until you can't stand it. He sighed and rolled onto his side. I think about you, she said. Don't. His voice was rough. You kissed me, she said. It wasn't a dream. You can't remember that. Isabel felt something strange at his words, a breathless little flutter in her chest. You want me as much as I want you, she said. He shook his head in denial, but it was the silence she heard, the acceleration of his breathing. You think I'm too young and too innocent and too impetuous, too everything. I get it. People have always said that about me. I'm immature. That's not it. But you're wrong. Maybe you weren't wrong 2 years ago. I did say I love you, which must have sounded insane. She drew in a breath. But it's not insane now, Gaetan. Maybe it's the only sane thing in all of this. Love, I mean. We've seen buildings blown up in front of us, and our friends are getting arrested and deported. God knows if we'll ever see them again. I could die, Gaetan, she said quietly. I'm not saying that in some schoolgirl try to get the boy to kiss me kind of way. It's true, and you know it. Either one of us could die tomorrow. And you know what I would regret?
What?
Us. There can't be an us, Iz. Not now. That's what I've been trying to tell you from the beginning. If I promise to let it go, will you answer one question truthfully?
Just one?
One. And then I'll go to sleep. I promise.
He nodded.
If we weren't here, hiding in a safe house, if the world weren't ripping itself apart, if this was just an ordinary day in an ordinary world, would you want there to be an us, Gaetan?
She saw how his face crumpled, how pain exposed his love.
It doesn't matter, don't you see that? It's the only thing that matters, Gaetan. She saw love in his eyes. What did words matter after that? She was wiser than she'd been before. Now she knew how fragile life and love were. Maybe she would love him for only this day, or maybe for only the next week, or maybe until she was an old, old woman. Maybe he would be the love of her life, or her love for the duration of this war, or maybe he would only be her first love. All she really knew was that in this terrible, frightening world, she had stumbled into something unexpected, and she would not let it go again.
I knew it, she said to herself, smiling.
His breath skimmed against her lips, as intimate as any kiss. She leaned over him, her gaze on him, steady, honest, and turned off the lamp. In the dark, she snuggled against him, burrowed deeper under the blankets. At first, he lay stiffly against her, as if he were afraid even to touch her, but gradually he relaxed. He rolled onto his back and started to snore. Sometime, she didn't know when, she closed her eyes and reached out, placing a hand in the hollow of his stomach, feeling it rise and fall with his breathing. It was like resting her hand on the ocean in summer when the tide was coming in. Touching him, she fell asleep. The nightmares wouldn't let her go. In some distant part of her brain, she heard her own whimpering, heard Sophie say, "Maman, you're taking all the blankets." But none of it wakened her. In her nightmare, she was in a chair, being interrogated. "The boy, Daniel, he's a Jew. Give him to me," von Richter said, shoving his gun in her face. Then his face changed, melted a little, and he turned into Beck, who was holding the photograph of his wife and shaking his head. But the side of his face was missing. And then Isabel lying on the floor, bleeding, saying, "I'm sorry, Vianne." And Vianne was yelling, "You're not welcome here." Vianne woke with a start, breathing hard. The same nightmares had plagued her for 6 days. She consistently woke, feeling exhausted and worried. It was November now, and there had been no word about Isabel at all. She eased out from beneath the blankets. The floor was cold, but not as cold as it would be in a few weeks. She reached for the shawl she'd left on the foot of the bed and wrapped it around her shoulders. Von Richter had claimed the upstairs bedroom. Vianne had abandoned the floor to him, choosing to move with her children into the smaller downstairs bedroom, where they slept together on the double bed. Beck's room. No wonder she dreamed of him in here. The air held on to his scent, reminded her that the man she'd known no longer lived, that she had killed him. She longed to do penance for this sin, but what could she do? She had killed a man, a decent man in spite of it all. It didn't matter to her that he was the enemy or even that she'd done it to save her sister. She knew she had made the right choice. It wasn't right or wrong that haunted her. It was the act itself. Murder. She left the bedroom and closed the door behind her, shutting it with a quiet click. Von Richter sat on the divan, reading a novel, drinking a cup of real coffee. The aroma made her almost sick with longing.
The Naxi had billeted here for several days already, and each of those mornings had smelled of rich, bitter, roasted coffee. And Von Richter made sure she smelled it and wanted it, but she couldn't have so much as a sip. He made sure of that, too. Yesterday morning, he had dumped an entire pot into the sink, smiling at her as he did so. He was a man who had stumbled into a little bit of power and seized it with both hands. She'd known that within the first few hours of his arrival, when he'd chosen the best room and gathered up the warmest blankets for his bed, when he'd taken all of the pillows left in the house and all of the candles, leaving Vianne a single oil lamp for her use. "Herr Sturmbannführer," she said, smoothing her shapeless dress and worn cardigan. He didn't look up from the German newspaper that held his attention. "More coffee." She took his empty cup and went to the kitchen, returning quickly with another cup. "The Allies are wasting their time in North Africa," he said, taking the cup from her, putting it on the table beside him. "Oui, Herr Sturmbannführer." She got out of his way quickly, hurrying into the bedroom and closing the door behind her. She bent and wakened Daniel, feeling his soft breathing against the crook of her neck. "Maman," he mumbled around his thumb, which he was furiously sucking. "Sophie is snoring too loud." Vianne smiled and reached over to tousle Sophie's hair. Amazingly, even though it was wartime and they were terrified and starving, somehow a girl her age could still manage to sleep through anything. "You sound like a water buffalo, Sophie," Vianne teased. "Very funny," Sophie muttered, sitting up. She glanced at the closed door. "Is Herr Dorifor still here?" "Sophie," Vianne admonished, glancing worriedly at the closed door. "He can't hear us," Sophie said. "Still," Vianne said quietly, "I cannot imagine why you would compare our guest to a bug that eats potatoes." She tried not to smile. Daniel hugged Vianne and gave her a sloppy kiss. As she patted his back and held him close, nuzzling the downy softness of his cheek, she heard a car engine start up. "Thank God." "He is leaving," she murmured to the boy, nuzzling his cheek. "Come along, Sophie." She carried Daniel into the living room, which still smelled of freshly brewed coffee and men's cologne, and began her day. People had called Isabel impetuous for as long as she could remember, and then rash, and most lately, reckless. In the past year, she had grown up enough to see the truth of it. From earliest memory, she had acted first and thought about consequences later. Perhaps it was because she'd felt alone for so long. No one had ever been her sounding board, her best friend. She hadn't had someone with whom to strategize or work through her problems. Beyond that, she had never had great impulse control, maybe because she'd never had anything to lose. Now she knew what it meant to be afraid, to want something, or someone, so much it made your heart ache. The old Isabel would simply have told Gaetan she loved him and let the cards fall as they would. The new Isabel wanted to walk away without even trying. She didn't know if she had the strength to be rejected again. And yet, they were at war. Time was the one luxury no one had anymore. Tomorrow felt as ephemeral as a kiss in the dark. She stood in the small pitch-roof cupboard they used as a water closet in the safe house. Gaetan had carried up buckets of hot water for her bath, and she had luxuriated in the copper tub until the water cooled. The mirror on the wall was cracked and hung askew. It made her reflection appear disjointed, with one side of her face slightly lower than the other. "How can you be afraid?" she said to her reflection. She had hiked the Pyrenees in the falling snow and swum the rushing cold waters of the Bidasoa River beneath the glare of a Spanish searchlight. She'd once asked a Gestapo agent to carry a suitcase full of false identity papers across a German checkpoint because he looked so strong and she was so very tired from traveling. But she had never been as nervous as she was right now. She knew suddenly that a woman can change her whole life and uproot her existence with one choice. Taking a deep breath, she wrapped herself in a tattered towel and returned to the safe house's main room. She paused at the door just long enough to calm her racing heart, a failed attempt, and then she opened the door. Gaetan stood by the blacked-out window in his torn and tattered clothes, still stained with her blood. She smiled nervously and reached for the end of the towel she tucked in at her chest. He went so still it seemed he'd stopped breathing, even as her breathing sped up. "Don't do it, Iz." His eyes narrowed. Before, she would have said it was anger, but now she knew better. She unwrapped the towel, let it fall to the floor. The bandage on her gunshot wound was all she wore now. "What do you want from me?" he said. "You know. You're an innocent. It's war. I'm a criminal. How many reasons do you need to stay away from me?" They were arguments for another world. "If times were different, I'd make you chase me," she said, taking a step forward. "I would have made you jump through hoops to get me naked. But we don't have time, do we?" At the quiet admission, she felt a wave of sadness. This had been the truth between them from the beginning. They had no time. They couldn't court and fall in love and get married and have babies. They might not even have tomorrow. She hated that her first time would be bathed in sorrow, steeped in a sense of having already lost what they just found. But that was the world now. One thing she knew for sure. She wanted him to be the first man in her bed. She wanted to remember him for as long as forever was. The nuns always said I would come to a bad end. I think they meant you. He came toward her, cupped her face in his hands. "You terrify me, Isabel." "Kiss me," was all she could say. At the first touch of his lips, everything changed, or Isabel changed. A shudder of desire moved through her, stopped her breath. She felt lost within his arms and found, broken apart and remade. The words, "I love you," burned in her, desperate to be given voice. But even more, she wanted to hear the words, to be told just once that she was loved. "You're going to be sorry you did this," he said. How could he say that? "Never. Will you be sorry?" "I already am," he said quietly. Then he kissed her again. Chapter 29. The next week was one of almost unbearable bliss for Isabel. There were long conversations by candlelight and holding hands and stroking skin, nights of awaking into an aching desire and making love and falling into sleep again. On this day, as on each of the others, Isabel woke, still tired and slightly in pain. The wound in her shoulder had begun healing enough that it itched and ached. She felt Gaetan beside her, his body warm and solid. She knew he was awake. Maybe it was his breathing, or the way his foot rubbed absently against hers, or the quiet. She just knew. In the past days, she'd become a student of him. Nothing he did was too small or insignificant for her to notice. She'd repeatedly thought, "Remember this," over the smallest of details. She had read countless romantic novels in her life, and she had dreamed of love forever. Even so, she'd never known that a plain old double mattress could become a world unto itself, an oasis. She turned onto his side and reached past Gaetan to light the lamp. In the pale glow of it, she settled close to him, an arm draped across his chest. A tiny silver scar cut through his messy hairline. She reached out to touch it, traced it with a fingertip. "My brother threw a rock at me. I was too slow to duck," he said. "Georges," he said fondly. The tenor of his voice reminded Isabel that Gaetan's brother was a prisoner of war. He had a whole life she knew almost nothing about. A mother who was a seamstress and a father who raised pigs. He lived in the woods somewhere, in a house with no running water and only a single room for all of them. He answered her questions about all of it, but volunteered almost nothing. He said he preferred to hear her stories about the adventures that had gotten her kicked out of so many schools. "It's better than stories of poor people just trying to get by," he said. But beneath all their words, the stories traded back and forth. She felt their time eroding. They couldn't stay here long. Already they'd overstayed. She was fit enough to travel. Not to cross the Pyrenees, perhaps, but certainly she didn't need to lie abed. How could she leave him? They might not ever see each other again. That was the crux of her fear. "I get it, you know," Gaetan said. She didn't know what he meant, but she heard the hollowness in his voice and knew it wasn't good. The sadness that came with being in his bed matched equally with joy, expanded. "Get what?" she asked, but she didn't want to hear. "That every time we kiss, it's goodbye." She closed her eyes. The war is out there, Iz. I need to get back to it. She knew and agreed, though it caused a constriction in her chest. I know, was all she could say, afraid that any deeper exploration would hurt more than she could bear. There is a group gathering at Uryam, she said. I should be there by nightfall on Wednesday, if we're lucky. We are not lucky, he said. You must know that by now. You are wrong, Gaetan. Now that you've met me, you'll never be able to forget me. That's something. She leaned over for a kiss. He said something softly, quietly, against her lips. Maybe it was, it's not enough. She didn't care. She didn't want to hear. In November, the people of Caravo began to hunker down into winter survival mode again. They knew now what they hadn't known last winter. Life could get worse. War was being waged all over the world, in Africa, in the Soviet Union, in Japan, on an island somewhere called Guadalcanal. With the Germans fighting on so many fronts, food had become even more scarce, as had wood and gas and electricity and everyday supplies. This Friday morning was particularly cold and gray. Not a good day for venturing out, but Vianne had decided that today was the day. It had taken some time to work up the courage to leave the house with Daniel, but she knew that it had to be done. His hair was cut so short he was almost bald, and she dressed him in oversized clothes to make him look smaller. Anything to disguise him. She forced herself to show good posture as she walked through town, with a child on each side of her, Sophie and Daniel. Daniel. At the boulangerie, she took her place at the back of the queue. She waited breathlessly for someone to ask about the boy beside her, but the women in line were too tired and hungry and downtrodden even to look up. When it was finally Vianne's turn at the counter, Yvette looked up. She had been a beautiful woman only 2 years ago, with flowing copper-colored hair and eyes as black as coal. Now, 3 years into the war, she looked aged and tired. Vianne Mauriac, I have not seen you with your daughter for a while. Bonjour, Sophie. You have grown so tall. She peered over the counter. And who is this good-looking young man? Daniel, he said proudly. Vianne placed a trembling hand on his shorn head. I adopted him from Antoine's cousin and niece. She died. Yvette pushed the frizzy hair out of her eyes, pulled a strand of it out of her mouth as she stared down at the toddler. She had 3 sons of her own, one not much older than Daniel. Vianne's heart hammered in her chest. Yvette stepped back from the counter. She went to the small door that separated the shop from the bakery. Herr Lieutenant, she said, could you come out here? Vianne tightened her grip on her willow basket handle, working it as if it were piano keys. A portly German ambled out of the back room, his arms overflowing with freshly baked baguettes. He saw Vianne and stopped. Madame, he said, his apple cheeks bulging at the fullness of his mouth. Vianne could barely nod. Yvette said to the soldier, there's no more bread today, Herr Lieutenant. If I make more, I will save the best for you and your men. This poor woman couldn't even get a day-old baguette. The man's eyes narrowed appreciatively. He moved toward Vianne, his flat feet thumping on the stone floor. Wordlessly, he dropped a half-eaten baguette into her basket. Then he nodded and left the shop, a little bell tinkling at his exit. When they were alone, Yvette moved in close to Vianne, so close she had to fight the urge to step back. I heard you have an SS officer in your house now. What happened to the handsome captain? He disappeared, Vianne said evenly. No one knows. No one? Why did they bring you in for questioning? Everyone saw you go in. I am just a housewife. What could I possibly know of such things? Yvette stared at her a moment longer, assessing Vianne in the silence. Then she stepped back. You are a good friend, Vianne Mauriac, she said quietly. Vianne nodded briefly and herded the children to the door. The days of stopping to talk to friends on the street were gone. Now it was dangerous enough to simply make eye contact. Friendly conversation had gone the way of butter and coffee and pork. Outside, Vianne paused on the cracked stone step, through which a lush patch of frosted weeds pushed up. She was wearing a winter coat she had made from a tapestried bedspread. She had copied a pattern she'd seen in a magazine, double-breasted, knee-length, with a wide lapel and buttons she'd taken from one of her mother's favorite Harris tweed jackets. It was warm enough for today, but soon she would need layers of newsprint between her sweater and her coat. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.